The opinions expressed by guests of this show are their own and do not necessarily align with those of us here at the Animal Soulmates podcast.
I write about this a bit in the book, but when I was younger, I often felt like a weirdo for how upset I was about my pets dying because people didn't openly really talk about it much with each other. And it was only when I started to make good friends who also had pets that they were deeply attached to, and I saw how upset they were when those pets died, that I began to realize, you know, oh, I'm not really alone in this. And then researching the book, it just really hammered home, you know, that whole point. Like, there are so many people out there and so many people feel so alone in their grief about a pet. But, you know, if you reach out to other people who've had animals, like, you're going to find a whole community of people who get it.
Welcome to the Animal Soulmates podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Abby Viscardi. I'm an animal welfare scientist and, more importantly, an obsessed dog mom. I believe that the unconditional love and connection that we share with our animals is more powerful than we realize. This podcast will honor the stories of these amazing creatures that have walked with us and changed our lives forever. So join me, and together we will explore the true power of the human-animal bond. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Animal Soulmates podcast. It is so crazy to say this, but we are more than halfway through season one. It is so wild. It's gone by incredibly fast, but I can say that this has just been an absolute blast for me to do. Obviously, as a scientist, I had some reservations about the idea of starting a podcast. This is a little outside my comfort zone, but I can honestly say I've loved every minute of this show. It has been so fun connecting with people, and I would love to keep this show going for many more seasons. I just think there are so many more of these stories to tell. So now would be such a great time, if you are enjoying the show, to give us a like, rate and review, share it with a friend. Let's get these animal soulmate stories out there. We are switching gears a little this week and chatting with an author of an incredible book called Good Grief on Loving Pets Here and Hereafter. In this book, E.B. Bartels details her life growing up with a range of animals, from fish to birds to a tortoise, and candidly discusses the impact of loving and losing each one. Within each chapter, she explores a different theme of pet loss, including the human-animal bond, of course, the importance of community, and options for honoring our pets after death. E.B. has a way of writing about pet loss and grief that makes you kind of lean in, if that makes sense, instead of shying away from the topic. And the more you read, the more you realize that you are not alone. When I say that I devoured this book, I mean I had read it and reached out to EB to see if she would do the podcast within 48 hours. Actually, from when I had this book suggested to me by a friend, shout out to Leah, I know you're listening, to when EB and I recorded this conversation, it was all within a week. So a little bit of a whirlwind. But I'm really glad that EB was able to fit me in her schedule, as I think we had a really great chat. Without further ado, please enjoy episode 7, an author of a book on loving and losing pets with EB Bartels.
My name is E.B. Bartels. I grew up and still live in Massachusetts, and I'm the author of Good Grief on Loving Pets Here and Hereafter.
And what was your childhood like growing up?
I grew up outside Boston in the, you know, Massachusetts suburbs, and I have three older siblings from my dad's first marriage. So Chad, Sarah, and Jen were always, you know, significantly older than me. They're 9 to 13 years older. And that meant they were always off like to the next thing while I was still at home. So, you know, while they were busy being in high school and getting into trouble and, you know, breaking out and living their own lives, I was at home a lot by myself. So I turned often to pets for company because that was who was around and who was at home. And it started off, I actually didn't have any pets at home in my house because my mom has really bad allergies and is very fastidious and clean and was adverse to the idea of having animals at home. But she made the mistake of sending me to this Montessori school in town that had tons of classroom pets. So there was a rabbit, there was different hamsters and guinea pigs, there was turtles who were named Sam and Ella, like Salmonella, which I didn't get for like years. There were two big iguanas in one of the classrooms, and there was even a tarantula in like the older kids' classroom. And I just was fascinated by having all these animals at school. And instead of being like satisfied that I had all these pets at school every day, I really wanted a pet of my own at home. So I campaigned really, really hard. And my poor mom like really took the brunt of it because my dad has always loved animals. He was super on board for any pet I wanted. But I wrote these really aggressive letters, like pleading, outlining all these points about why I deserve to have a pet at home. Honestly, that was probably the beginning of my career as a writer and writing like a persuasive essay. I would leave, you know, like newspaper clippings of people who were selling dogs and cats, you know, in the classified ads out on the table. And I would, you know, leave the encyclopedia open to the D page with like all the different dog breeds. Eventually, I did wear my mom down. So then I grew up with sort of like a series of escalating pets. So it started with fish, and then I had birds, and then I had a series of turtles, and then one very memorable tortoise named Aristotle. Eventually, I got dogs as well. So I grew up with two Karen Terriers named Gus and Gwen, who I got in fourth and sixth grade and who lived until I was in college and grad school.
Yeah. And I think what's really interesting about your life growing up with animals is you have such a range of experience bonding to not just kind of the prototypical dog and cat, but you had fish and birds and tortoises and sort of a, you know, a range of relationships with each of these different species. So I'd love if we could talk a little bit about some of those maybe not so common animal species that you had growing up. So if we wanted to talk about Kiki first, your canary.
Yeah. So as I said, I started with fish because I feel like fish are sort of like the gateway drug of pets, right?
Yes.
You know, it's easy to convince parents because it's like they're contained. They stay in one part of the house, you know, but it's funny to me because actually I think personally fish are one of the hardest pets to keep alive and healthy and happy because, you know, you do one tiny thing like change the temperature in the tank and then all the fish die, you know. Or my husband keeps African cichlids and they need this very specific salinity of water. So it's not like a full saltwater tank, but it's not pure freshwater either. And he's always like testing the water and measuring the levels. And so it's funny to me in some ways that I feel like parents choose this really challenging pet as like a first pet. But anyway, I love my fish. I loved watching them, but I felt really strongly that I wanted a more interactive pet. Like, I think in some ways fish felt passive, like they were doing their thing in their environment. I, of course, helped care for it and curate it and all that. But I began to push to get a bird, in part because actually my mom grew up with a parakeet. So I kind of thought like, okay, maybe I can use this like nostalgia angle to get her to get another bird. And that bird she grew up with was also named Kiki. So technically my Kiki was Kiki too. But I convinced her, and Kiki was really special because, I mean, he was not a big fan of mine necessarily. He was a little skittish. Like, he was a Gloucester canary, which is like a type of finch. And they're a little more hands off than like, you know, a parakeet or parrot you can really train to interact with you. But I thought it was so cool to learn about his personality. Like, he had very specific taste. Like, you would give him a seed stick and he would pick off certain seeds first that he liked more than others. Or he loved broccoli. Like, you would put a crown of broccoli into his cage and he would like pick all the little like flower, whatever they're called, you know, off the broccoli. And it was just really cool to get to know him and see in this interactive way, like, oh, I can do this and he'll respond in this way. So I felt like that was my first experience of really on a daily basis getting to know an animal and getting to understand, you know, their personality, their likes, their dislikes, their interests. And I was obsessed with Kiki. Like, I threw him elaborate birthday parties every year. He lived pretty long, actually, for a finch. I think it was maybe like 6 years, because I got him when I was, oh man, well, like five, I can't remember, but it was a while, and he was a big part of my life, and I loved having this bird around, so that was really cool. But I really feel like sometimes having pets is like an addiction, because you get a taste of it and you're like, oh my gosh, now I want to get to know more animals, and they all have these different personalities and they're so, you know, smart and special in their own way. So then I was desperate then to get more birds or turtles or tortoises or dogs or, like, you know, anything else my mom would let me have. So Kiki really, I think, started it all.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you talked about two other, are they finches that you had as well? And the one finch you don't even remember the name, just sort of lost in the ether of time.
Yeah. So I got a zebra finch to keep Kiki company because I was worried he was lonely. And her name was Finny, and she lived for a couple years. But then I think that, I don't know if they got some bird flu, or birds can be very sensitive to drafts. So like if you move them to a different place, like where they're not used to being, they can get sick. So Finny died, and then the replacement zebra finch also died very quickly after that. And then Kiki also died. So it was sort of like this bird tragedy sort of all right in a row. Though pretty soon after Kiki died, it was summer of 97, I then got Gus, our first dog, that fall. I think in part because my parents felt so bad that Kiki died.
And do you mind talking about the day that you found Kiki passed away? I think you talk about it a little bit in the book, and I just thought what your mom did was really very sweet in that moment.
Yeah, so my mom, it's funny, she really does have bad allergies, but she told me later when I was an adult that she actually was stalling more from letting me get my own pets because, not so much her allergies, but more because she was worried how upset I would be when a pet inevitably died, because very few pets will live as long as a person does. So I came home from, it was in the summer, I was at like classical violin camp. I came home that afternoon and I saw Kiki was on the bottom of the cage. And, you know, he was lying in a position that was totally unnatural. He was like splayed. And, you know, it would have been very easy for my mom to say, like, this bird is dead. Like, this is the end. Like, let's talk about that. But I was absolutely hysterical. I was so upset. And I was like, maybe there's something the vet can do. And so my mom was really kind and looked up exotic vets in the area. There were only two. And she figured kind of which one maybe was the easiest to try to get to during rush hour traffic. And it was still like 45 minutes away. We drove Kiki. I am sitting in the front seat holding this bird that is 100% dead, but I'm refusing to accept it. And we go, and the exotic vet looks and confirms that this is the case. And, you know, I, of course, then run out to the car. I'm crying. But it felt really, really kind in retrospect that my mom went to all that effort because she knew how much I cared about this bird. And she was like, you know, it was sort of absurd, right, to drive 45 minutes in rush hour traffic to pay to have a vet tell us what we already knew. But, you know, she was just thinking about how much I cared for and loved this pet. And she wanted me to feel like I had done everything I could to try to help him, even if really by the time I came home from camp, like, he was already gone. I really appreciated my mom doing that. And it's funny because my mom now has become like totally like will go to all ends of the earth to help her pets. She has a rescue dog now named Honey, and like Honey has dry eye and gets special eye drops. And I'll go over to the house and I'll be like, wow, something smells great. My mom's like roasting whole chickens just for Honey. You know, it's like, it's funny. I joke that I converted my mom to be a total pet person.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah, there was something about that that just was so heartwarming to me, that it obviously, like you said, she very easily could have sat you down and said, you know, this is, your fish had already passed away. You understand death to a certain degree. And you would have been, what, 10 or 11 at that point?
Yeah, 9 or 10, I think.
Yeah. But it just to go to that extra length, I think, was just very, it just showed her kindness towards the whole situation and really understanding what this animal meant to you. Even though, again, what we had talked about before is that some people might just see it as, oh, it's just a bird, like she'll get over it. But I don't know. I think that was just such a kind way to go about the situation.
Definitely.
And then so what was the time frame between, so you got Gus the dog pretty shortly after, and then Aristotle overlapped with Gus and Gwen, or just Gus?
Let me see. I got Gus in the fall of fourth grade, and then I got Gwen in the summer before sixth grade. And then I, you know, love these dogs, but like I was saying, like one pet was never enough. And also Gus like immediately fixated on my dad. Like he was my dad's like soulmate dog. My dad still cries talking about Gus. And I don't know what it was. The two of them just were kindred spirits. And in the summer, my dad loves to go fishing, and Gus every morning, they would get up at like 5 a.m. They'd go down to the boat. Gus would sit like up on the captain's chair and bark at seagulls. And it was my dad's favorite thing in the whole world. We ended up, when Gus died, we scattered his ashes by the lighthouse where they would always go fishing. And my dad has said that when he dies, he wants his ashes scattered there as well. You know, in part because he loves the place, but I think also because he wants to be with Gus, which my mom is trying not to take personally. So anyway, Gus came into our family and clearly chose my dad. So then that was part of why we got Gwen, because my mom and I were sort of like, well, what the hell? Like, why doesn't this dog want to be with us? So Gwen definitely was like more like hung out with me and my mom. But I also had just always been fascinated by tortoises. I have a little tattoo of a turtle.
So cute.
Yeah. One of my favorite books growing up was Esio Trot by Roald Dahl, which is about a man who is in love with the woman who lives downstairs from him, but she only has eyes for her pet tortoise. And so he helps her through like swapping out the tortoises, make the tortoise grow bigger in size. And anyway, I like loved this book. I always loved reading about turtles and tortoises. And I think something that was really appealing to me about tortoises in particular is how long they can live. So I loved Gus and Gwen, but I think a little part of me was like, dogs live 8 to 10 to 12, maybe 15 years, you know? And I was sort of doing the math and was like, well, what is the way I can like cheat pet death? And tortoises and parrots are basically the two animals that really live the longest in terms of pets. Parrots, actually, they live so long, and it's really challenging because they bond really well with one specific person, that if that person dies or like goes into assisted living or something, parrots can actually have a really, really difficult time being rehomed and adjusting. Anyway, I just thought tortoises were cool, so I was sort of leaning towards tortoises, and I ended up saving a bunch of my money from, you know, babysitting and allowance and stuff. So then I believe it was the summer before seventh grade that I got Aristotle, who is a Bell's hingeback tortoise, which is a type of African desert tortoise. Yeah, and I thought he was really cool, and he looked like, you know, this wise old man, and he would walk around in the grass outside with Gus and Gwen, and Gus and Gwen didn't really know what to make of him. They all kind of ignored each other, even though I always tried to do these photo shoots of them together. And it was really interesting, too, to have these three pretty different pets at the same time who all had really distinct personalities and likes and dislikes and interests. And like Gwen actually always hated the boat. So like, for as much as Gus loved going fishing, Gwen was terrified of the boat. She hated the car. And then Aristotle like had very particular taste about like what greens he would eat and what he wouldn't eat. And so it was really special, I think, to get to have this time with all three of them and kind of get to compare and get to know them in their own ways.
And Aristotle, how did you come up with that name? I think it's just so perfect for a tortoise.
I had this book, I actually still have it, that's like 3001 names for a baby. And I used to use it when I bought it at like a craft store when I was in elementary school. And I used to use it to name my pets and my stuffed animals, because I like to look up what meanings there are behind names for my pets. And with Aristotle, I didn't know much about Greek philosophy at the time. I took a philosophy course in college, college eventually, but I just liked that it was the name of a philosopher because he looked like this kind of wise old man. So I chose Aristotle for that reason.
Oh my God, so perfect. And then so when you think about, obviously Kiki came in your life when you were younger and then Aristotle when you were older, what was the kind of legacy that these two animals left on you? Or what was kind of the wisdom that they imparted on you when they passed?
Yeah, so Kiki's death was very definite, you know, I saw him dead. I brought him to the vet. The vet confirmed his death. We had a funeral for him in the backyard. It was cut and dry that that is what had happened. Aristotle, unfortunately, so I had him for about 2.5 years, I think, maybe 3. And as I was saying, we used to let him kind of wander around on the grass in the backyard. And at the summer house my parents rented 1 year, there was no fence or anything. So we would kind of just let him wander around. And as long as someone was out there keeping an eye on him, he wouldn't get very far. Though tortoises, when they're in the wild, they actually do this zigzagging while they're walking. So they're slow, but it's really easy to lose track of them because you think, oh, they're heading that way. And then you look down for a second and you look back up and all of a sudden they're way over on the opposite side because they're trying to, you know, avoid predators. So anyway, one day Aristotle was out walking around in the grass. My dad was keeping an eye on him. The phone rang inside the house. My dad went inside to answer it and lost track of time. Came out, Aristotle was gone. And my dad obviously felt terrible. He still feels terrible. You know, I still give him a hard time for this 20 years later. But Aristotle's death was interesting because I didn't get confirmation that he died. I made assumptions that he did because he was this African desert tortoise species. And this happened in, you know, coastal New England. So at a certain point, even if he made it through, you know, the summer and the fall eating grass or whatever, I couldn't imagine really he would have survived the winter. Maybe he could have figured out how to hibernate, but probably not. And so his death was really interesting because it forced me to think differently about loss. And there's a term I learned when I was researching my book called ambiguous loss. There's a really great book about it. And that term covers all sorts of losses. So often, you know, family members of people who are prisoners of war, or maybe their plane got shot down in combat, their body was never recovered. So you're pretty sure they're dead, but you don't have that physical body to confirm. Or parents of children who are kidnapped and are missing and they're never found and you don't really know. And similarly with pets, pets do run away a lot. And I know people, you know, who've lost cats who have assumed maybe my cat got eaten by a coyote when she was outside. I don't necessarily know. Cats are also notorious for going to die, out in the woods or under the deck or in places where you can't find them. So I know a lot of people who have these sort of challenging losses because there is something really comforting about seeing the body and confirming, okay, this being that I love is no longer here. You know, this is someone described it to me as the house that once, you know, was the home for the soul, but the soul is elsewhere. And, you know, I think there's so many traditions in different cultures where you wash the deceased body, you dress them, you know, you have a wake, you have, you sit Shiva and talk about the fact that they are gone. And I think all those things actually really help you accept the loss. But when the animal person is just missing and you don't necessarily know what happened, it's much harder to process. And so Aristotle's death, I was always sort of a tiny part of me, every summer we would go back to the same place where he had disappeared. And I would think, maybe he'll happen to show up. I had this idea that just maybe he would somehow appear. So it took a much longer to come to terms with that. And I also think another reason why Aristotle's loss was harder was because I had chosen him as a pet because I had heard he could live up to 60 years. And so I did that math that I was, you know, in seventh grade, I was like, what, 13? So I was like, oh my gosh, I could have Aristotle until I'm like well into my retirement years, you know? And I've read so many wonderful essays. Like there's an essay I love in Modern Love about an author and her pet tortoise and basically like all the decades they spend together. And I was really sad about his loss in general for like present me, but I also was mourning this whole future I had written of us together, of like, I was going to bring him with me to college. He was going to live in my first apartment, you know, like he would meet my kids. He would become my kid's pet, you know? And that was, it was hard to let go of all that as well. So I think between those two deaths, you know, from Kiki, I really learned there's so much value in rituals and actually like looking death in the eye and seeing the body, seeing the, you know, the shell and the loss and accepting it. But then also Aristotle's death really taught me that life is not as neat and clean and cut and dry as we hope, even when it comes to life and death. And that sometimes you have to adjust and figure out other ways to grieve and mourn and accept a loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that loss associated with the time that we were supposed to have together that got cut short, I think that that's an aspect of grief that maybe we don't really acknowledge or we don't talk too much about. Like when you know a dog's average lifespan is, you know, 10 to 12 years, and then they have sort of a freak accident, or maybe they get a really sort of rare disease at 3 and they have to be put down. It's like, well, I was supposed to have you and love you for another 10 years. And I didn't get that. And I think that that's an aspect of grief for sure, that we don't really, maybe we don't know enough about it, or we don't talk enough about it. So there isn't that sort of awareness.
Yeah. And I've, you know, experienced a lot of losses in my life of both pets and also people, and people of all different ages. And, you know, when just this winter, actually, both my husband and I lost our grandmothers, and they both were in their 90s. And so that's sad, like we miss them, but also, you know, they both led these incredible lives. They had, you know, almost a century's worth of experiences and memories, and you don't really feel like you're cheated out of something, you know, just you miss them, right? And then my aunt, 12 years ago now, she died when she was 49. And to me, that just feels, especially now that I'm 36, that feels super young. And, you know, it's hard because that loss came with both sadness of missing her, but also anger at, like, you know, I felt like when she died, we were just really starting to have our own relationship sort of outside of my mom and my grandmother. You know, we had things in common that, you know, other people in our family did not. And so, like, you know, she was also an artist, and we were always like trading sort of like, you know, watercolors we liked back and forth and things like that. And so I felt this loss of, like, I was supposed to have this whole life with my aunt that, you know, was gone like 50 years before it should have been.
Yeah. And I think it makes sense to a lot of people when you put it in the context of another human being, but maybe when you put it in the context of a pet or quote unquote just an animal, doesn't seem to ring as true for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I think it's so interesting to me how even in, especially in America in 2024, people are so obsessed with their pets. Like people, you know, the term fur parent, you know, pet parent, people really treat their pets like full family members. They spend more money on their animals than ever before. A lot of people have pets instead of choosing to have kids. You know, it's hilarious. Like my grandfather, who's 89, like he always makes these comments like, when I was a kid, like we just had dogs and they lived outside and ate like whatever we had for dinner, like leftovers. You know what I mean? Like to him, it's like so over the top now that like my parents are buying like special organic dog food for their like rescue dog. But even so, it's mind blowing to me that like in this day and age, people still get really insensitive comments when their pet dies, you know, like, well, oh, like, you know, I saw the MSPCA, you know, has tons of puppies right now. Aren't you going to just go down and get a new puppy? Like, that would be so great. You should do that, you know, or like do it now. And then, you know, train the puppy and it could be a Christmas gift for your kids. And it's like, these comments that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily say those about people. And I do think part of it is legally animals are still considered property. I did some reading. There was actually originally a much longer tangent on this in the book. And my editor was like, you can scale this back a bit. But I was really interested in people who die and try to leave possessions to their pets, because legally you can't do that. Like in the law, it would be like you trying to leave your toaster to your television. But there are workarounds in terms of you can set up like a trust, like a trust fund, and that can fund the care of a pet. So it's like you're not leaving $5 million to your dog, but you're putting together a $5 million trust. And then there's a person that you have to name that's like in charge of the money, in charge of the pet's care. And then obviously, like, I read all these horror stories about people who like claimed they were using the money to care for the pet. They had actually like given the pet to a shelter and they were keeping it for themselves, you know, all this stuff. But I think because in some ways animals are still considered legally property, that's sort of like a subconscious thing where it's like, well, you lost this thing that you love as opposed to this family member, this creature, this friend, you know, who lives with you. And to me, the thing that I feel really strongly about since writing this book and talking about it a lot is that you cannot assume what someone's relationship is based with anybody else just by looking at what's written on paper. So people have all kinds of complicated relationships with each other, right? You know, someone, their dad may die and therefore they're entitled to X amount of, you know, bereavement days, weeks from work, but they may have been estranged from their dad and not spoken to their dad in, you know, 30 years and honestly don't really care that much that their dad died. But you could have somebody who lives with a cat who they live alone. The cat is their only like family member who lives close by. They spend every night snuggling with the cat in bed. They watch TV together. They share food. And losing that cat and losing that everyday companion is really, really traumatic and difficult. Maybe way more so than an older relative, a relative you didn't see very often, who lives far away, who you're estranged from. And even just pets are such a big part of our routines as well. Like, I have a friend who was telling me about when his dog died. He works from home. And so his dog was like his anchor in terms of making sure he left the house like 4 or 5 times a day, and they would go for walks. And like, he would remember to get up and stretch and get away from his computer because his dog would need to eat, you know, breakfast and stuff like that. And when his dog died, like 3 days went by and he was like, I haven't showered. I haven't left the house. Like, I keep forgetting to feed myself because it just threw off his whole routine. So I think that, you know, it's not really fair to assume what someone's relationship is. Like, oh, it's just a dog. It's just a cat. Like, that definitely may not be true. And there's some people who, like, you know, maybe in their families do think about pets as sort of like a fun supplement to their family, but it's not their whole world. So, but, you know, it's really different for everybody, just like it's different your relationships with different people, right? Like, you know, I've had friends who, you know, their cousin dies, which sounds like this more distant relationship, but they also were roommates at one point and their cousin's like their best friend, you know? So it's like, you can't really necessarily assume what someone's relationship is, regardless of, you know, relationship, species, whatever.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting too, that a household can suffer a loss of a pet and every member of that household will react to that grief very differently. So even though they all knew this animal, their relationship could be so distinctly different that their grief looks different. I think it's really important also to like make space for people in allow them to grieve the way that they need to grieve. Because I know some people, when they lose an animal, they want to talk about the animal, share stories about the animal, look at pictures, kind of be very active and engaged in the mourning process. And there's others that kind of like, I need to just kind of shut it out for a bit and grieve before I can allow all of that back in.
Yeah, that is something that a lot of people I interviewed for my book talked about how challenging that was. You know, like in a family, if there was like a certain meal they would always cook that the dog would go nuts for, right? Like somebody maybe wants to make that meal a lot because eating it reminds them of their dog and makes them feel like the dog's not that far away. And someone else might start crying at the smell of like, you know, turkey tacos or whatever it was that the dog would like. And I interviewed some vets who said even just like in the moment of like euthanizing a pet, often family members were conflicted. Some wanted to be in the room with the animal at the end. Some absolutely could not handle it and like needed to walk away immediately. Some want to sit with the body for a long time. Some don't. My grandfather, when his Yorkie died, he like immediately went around the house, gathered up her bed, her toys. He gathered up anything that reminded him of her. And he just went and threw it in the dumpster behind his office and was just like, didn't speak about her for like 30 years, basically, because it was too hard. While other people I know then go and get like pet memorial tattoos and, you know, put together beautiful photo albums and stuff. And it's hard when that's in the same family and one person wants to talk and the other person doesn't. So one thing that I think is really important, which I'm always talking about now, is that I think it's important to have these conversations long before your pet dies. Because when you're grieving, it's already so hard to make decisions. You know, like if you've ever had to plan a funeral for someone while you're actively mourning and you just get that decision fatigue, you're like, I don't care what the flowers look like. I'm just so tired of having to decide things. And with a pet, you know, if you're upset and everyone in your family wants something different, you know, it can be really tricky. And so it's nice, I think, to have conversations ahead of time with your family members about, okay, this is what we should do for this pet, or this is what I want. This is what you want. Can we figure out a compromise? Like when Gus died, my parents and I hadn't talked about it at all, really. And Gus died on the younger side. He had just turned 9 and he had this sort of intestinal disease, so he couldn't digest food properly. So we thought we were going to have him a lot longer than we did. And the vet euthanized him and just sort of was like, well, do you want to cremate him? Because that's what most people do. And we were like, okay. And then, you know, she said, do you want it as a group or individual? And my mom very quickly felt strongly it had to be individual. So we were like, okay. And then that was it. But then like a few weeks later, when we got his ashes back, we were kind of like, we didn't even really think through this. We just did it because it was offered to us as, you know, a common option. And so we did that. But with Gwen, because, you know, she died after Gus, we did talk a bit ahead of time. And my mom said, she was like, Gwen was always such a homebody. Like Gus would run away all the time. But like if the door was open, Gus would be like on the other side of the neighborhood, like making friends with everybody. And Gwen would like just walk outside and be sitting on the stairs waiting to be let back in, basically. So my mom was like, I think Gwen shouldn't be cremated. We should bring her body home and we should bury it in the yard. And my dad and I agreed, but we talked about that like well before she died. So I have some friends who joke that like I should go down to dog parks and give my book out to anybody who is like a puppy and be like, start talking about this now. But really, you know, I've heard of families having like horrific fights because somebody wants to do one thing and somebody wants to do something else. And they didn't talk about it until they were all grieving and upset and already in not a good place. And then you're also trying to make this big decision for your family as well.
I was going to say, as you were talking about decision making and thinking about these things before you're in grief, that I think that your book is such a great companion piece for people to have who are needing to make those types of decisions before their pet passes away, because you present so much information in, well, first of all, you're very raw and very honest in your book. And I think that that like genuine writing really comes through. But I think you present it in such a like palatable way. Like you don't present grief in this book as like a scary thing that we shouldn't talk about and we shouldn't think about. It's presented in very much a like, we have our pets for a finite amount of time and we honor them in life, and how can we honor them in death as well? And so I think it helps reframe the way we think about death of our pets too. And exactly what you're saying, you presented so many different options for end of life care and what to do after the pet passes away that, I mean, to be honest, I hadn't even heard about that these were options that we could have for our pets. So I think that, I mean, maybe your friend was saying in jest, but honestly, like I think this is a fantastic book for people that need to have these types of conversations or need to be thinking about these things long before they're in grief, but not in a way that sort of scares them away from grief. It's like, this is, you know, a part of life. And yeah, it's something that we can do the way that we need to do it.
Yeah, I think for me, the way I've really started to think about grief is it's hard. It's something that everyone goes through at different points in their life. But at least when you're mourning a pet, it's a really special chance to kind of celebrate this animal that was such a big part of your life. And something that I thought was really cool while I was doing research for my book was just the wildly varied ways that people mourn their pets. And I think, again, going back to what I said about pets being property, like you have a little more leeway in what you get to do, right? So like I have a chapter where I talk about taxidermy and cloning, which last I checked, I don't think is legal to have your grandmother taxidermied. But, you know, you can do these different things and, you know, you can figure out what feels most fitting and right to celebrate your animal's life or what will help you grieve and mourn. And, you know, a lot of people often choose traditions and customs that are close to what they do for human family members, in part maybe because that's what they're most comfortable with. That's what they know how to do best. So I interviewed one couple who's Jewish. And so when their dog died, they sat Shiva, they invited people over, you know, they did sort of exactly what they would have done for a human family member, but with their dog. But then you can also do things like I interviewed this awesome woman named Monica, who had her Boston Terrier taxidermied. And she's like very artistic and thinks like, you know, his fur is really beautiful. He had a very distinctive face. And so she felt like it was making like a sculpture in his honor in a way, which I hadn't really thought about taxidermy like that before, but it was really cool. And she loves like seeing his form and feeling like he's still there. Like she acknowledges that he's not alive anymore, but it's feel special to her to be able to see him in that way. Yeah, I think something that is very freeing about pets dying is that you can really do anything you want to memorialize them. And my philosophy really has become that, you know, as long as you're not hurting yourself or hurting other people, like grieve in any way you need to grieve.
Did you find that in researching this book and writing this book that it changed your perspective about grief and pet death? Or did you always kind of have a very open relationship with it?
It changed my perspective in that I write about this a bit in the book, but when I was younger, I often felt like a weirdo for how upset I was about my pets dying because people didn't openly really talk about it much with each other. And it was only when I started to make good friends who also had pets that they were deeply attached to, and I saw how upset they were when those pets died, that I began to realize, you know, oh, I'm not really alone in this. And then researching the book, it just really hammered home, you know, that whole point. Like there are so many people out there and so many people feel so alone in their grief about a pet. But, you know, if you reach out to other people who've had animals, like you're going to find a whole community of people who get it. So my perspective didn't change, but was like solidified by that research. And also, I guess the thing that sort of did change was me realizing like, oh, you really actually need people to help get through the death of a pet. Because often I think people who love their pets a lot maybe feel awkward with other people. Or like when I was a kid, I didn't have a lot of other like siblings or friends my age. So I really relied heavily on my pets. But then when the pet dies, who do you rely on, you know, to help you? So that was different. Though I've never really felt strictly like, you know, you have to do grief in a certain way or have certain traditions. And I guess researching the book made me see just how many different options there are out there for pets and for honestly mourning people as well. I've had a few people read my book who had recently lost. My friend read it right after her husband died, and another family member read it after her father died. And they both said, you know, reading my book actually kind of helped them with their grief over people as well. But the main thing that my perspective did really change on, which I was surprised by totally, is the chapter about euthanasia, choosing when to euthanize a pet or put down a pet. That's always been a really hard decision. Anybody I know who has pets has really struggled with that, right? Like this is the whole question of sort of like, what right do I have to decide when they die? How do I know it's the right time? So many people I talked to, most people always said, I know I probably should have done it sooner, but I was having a hard time letting go. But interviewing all these different vets for my book and hearing them talk about the fact that euthanasia is actually a really wonderful gift we can give to pets who are suffering and in a lot of pain. And they can die in this way that is very you know, peaceful and painless, and they can be surrounded by those they love. They're vets now who will come to your house and euthanize your pet at home so they can be in a place where they feel safe. And I was really surprised that after researching and writing so much about this, I'm now super, super pro death with dignity, because to me, I don't understand how come we can do this for our pets, but human beings often who can express themselves what they want, you know, in life, there are laws that prevent this kind of thing from happening. But, you know, I do think euthanasia, it can feel like a really scary, hard decision to make, but it's actually a gift you're giving to your pet, you know, so they don't suffer for longer than they need to.
And I will say, if anyone listening has experienced taking, you know, someone you love off life support, and you have to basically just sit there and watch them suffer until they pass, it really does change your perspective about euthanasia. Because my Nana, we had to do that for her, and it was awful. Like, it just, it made you feel like, why can we offer this kindness to our pets, and yet with our people, we just have to sit there and kind of watch them gasp and suffer until they pass. So yeah, I know it's a very controversial topic, but I think having experienced a pet euthanasia and then experienced taking a human that I love off life support, and it felt much more peaceful and kind when my animal was euthanized, for sure.
Yeah, I always think about one of the vets I interviewed is a veterinary oncologist. And he talked about when his own father was dying from, I think it was pancreatic cancer. It was very painful. And his dad said to him, he was like, how come you can't do for me what you do for all your, you know, the pet patients that you see? And it is a controversial topic. And I know, you know, there are lots of different factors that go into it in terms of ethics and religious beliefs. But I hope it's something that we can talk about more as a culture going forward and think about different options. Because, yeah, I've also watched people in hospice care who, you know, the only way that they're not in atrocious pain is that they're on so much morphine, they're not even awake anymore. And it's just, it feels cruel, honestly. So, you know, I think if you are someone who has a pet who is sick or elderly, you know, and you're hemming and hawing over the euthanasia decision, like, yes, it's not one to be taken lightly, but also remember that you're actually really doing a kindness to your pet in the end.
Yeah. So another thing that kind of struck me about your book too, is that you traveled to a bunch of different places and actually visited areas where pet grief was kind of all around you. So different cemeteries, for example. Was there a place that you visited that kind of stuck with you or maybe surprised you in what you experienced there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I joke that for a while, I wrote this book over the course of almost 10 years, and I was working on it long before I actually had a book deal. I was just sort of doing my own research kind of as I went along. I joked that for a while, anytime I was scheduled to go somewhere else for either like a writing conference or a wedding or like a girls trip, like, or whatever, I would also then Google pet cemeteries in X place. And then I would always kind of break off from the group and go like check out the local pet cemetery and then, you know, head back. And in 2017, my best friend from college, she moved to Japan in 2012. So in 2017, who my boyfriend at the time, now my husband and I, we went to visit her. And so naturally, I Googled pet cemeteries in Japan. And I found this one in Western Tokyo. So it's sort of like more like the suburbs of Tokyo. And it was the first international pet cemetery I visited. So I wasn't really sure what to expect, because the pet cemeteries in the United States are often very, very similar to human cemeteries and how they're laid out. People often, you know, put crosses or Stars of David or passages from like the Quran, like things that they would do in a human cemetery, but for their pets as well. It's just like the headstones are smaller, and often it says like in loving memory of Mr. Spaghetti, you know, or it's like the names are sort of more whimsical and funny. But I was curious to see, you know, a lot of people told me when I was explaining what my book was about, oh, well, yeah, of course, Americans are obsessed with their pets. Like, of course, Americans would have pet cemeteries. And I kept thinking like, well, no, I mean, I'm doing all this research and I learned in my book, like there are super ancient pet cemeteries that are thousands and thousands of years old. And they are like all throughout, you know, like the Middle East and, you know, in Israel and in like Central Europe. And then there are a ton above the Arctic Circle actually as well, because all these different indigenous cultures are very attached to their dogs because like they couldn't survive without hunting and sled dogs. But I was curious to kind of see like what a more contemporary pet cemetery in a different country was like, if it was, okay, this is a very American thing I'm writing about, or is this like a more universal world experience? And so Richie is such a good sport. We took like four different trains to trek all the way out to this pet cemetery on like Western Tokyo. And we went, and it was set up differently. It was set up in the style of, you know, with Buddhist shrines. So like these little cubbies where people would light incense and they would have photos of their pets and they would leave offerings of pet food or like squeaky toys or catnip and stuff like that and flowers. So similar to what you would do to honor a shrine of a person, but with, you know, the pet sort of variation. But like it just, it looked a little different in the setup, but it felt the same. Like the love and the like care people put into these, you know, shrines to their animals and the messages that they would leave and write for them were just so moving. And I was really struck by the fact that like, you know, people who love pets, it does not matter what, you know, if it's past or present, if it's in the US or if it's in Japan, like people really, really connect with animals in special ways. And they're really, really hit hard when those animals die. So I will never forget that. And we also happened to be there in the middle of March, and the temple does these memorial sort of mass memorial services on the equinoxes. So we were there in for the spring equinox, and we happened to be there on the day where they were doing sort of one of these memorials. So these Buddhist monks came, they lit incense, they did chanting, and there were all these people there who just came to pay respects to their pets. And then they were kind of cleaning up their cubbies and kind of refreshing flowers and leaving new offerings. And it was just like, it was such a joyful place too. There's something that I love about pet cemeteries all over the world that I've been to, because no one forces you to bury your pet in a pet cemetery. You know, it's a completely optional choice you can make as a pet owner. So everyone who's there, I think, just like really loved their pet a lot and still loves their pet. And so like, I just love the community that sort of comes from it. And it was really cool just to see that it was the same in Japan as it was in, you know, like Dedham, Massachusetts.
Yeah. And I think what's so cool about that is that it doesn't matter what language you speak or what race you are, your love for an animal transcends all of that. Like it's just such a, I don't know, in this society where sometimes things feel very divisive, I think what we can say constantly, regardless of religion or politics or whatever, is our love for our animals. It just seems to kind of transcend all of that.
Yeah, I interviewed several people for my book who I think if I had met them outside of the context of researching my book, we would have felt like we had nothing to talk about, like just very different politics, different backgrounds. But, you know, with pets, it's just, it's the same. And something I think about all the time is like, you know, even like serial killers have dogs who love them, you know, and dogs don't necessarily know that they're like bad people. They just, they love them, you know, or, you know, celebrities have pets who like, they don't know that they, you know, are the famous Instagram cat of like, you know, Karl Lagerfeld or whatever, but like, they just like love to be with their people. And so I think that's something that's really special about pets too. They're very kind of grounding and down to earth. And it's a really nice way to connect with somebody. If you're maybe not sure you have a lot of other things in common, if you both have like a dog, there's definitely stuff you can talk about.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's like my go-to way to connect with people. If there's someone who's like, oh my God, Sarah can't stop talking about her cat, I'll like find Sarah and be like, so I hear you have a cat. Like, tell me everything. It's just, yeah, it's such an easy way to connect with people. Yeah, I love that about pets. Something that I really liked that you touched on in your book, and I certainly have felt this, is that kind of in today's society, we obviously we have our own pets and our own animals in our community that we interact with, but we have the internet and we have social media. And I know so many people who have Instagram pages for their pets. And I feel like every animal person that I chat with, there's like an Instagram page, like a page that they are like, oh, this is my go-to pet page. Like there's tons of different examples of this. But then when something happens to the animal that you've been following for years on Instagram, you do feel grief about it. And I think that that's very interesting that you feel like you know these animals through their social media page, even though you've never met them and never interacted with them, but yet you can still feel grief, even if they're not feeling well or, oh, they're going in to get a procedure, send good vibes. And you're just like, oh my gosh, you think about this animal the whole day until you get that Instagram update that says, oh, they're out of surgery, they're fine. I love that you talked about that a little bit in your book as well.
Yeah, that to me has been very interesting because, well, for two reasons. One, I think the internet's a really nice way to get to know the pets of people who you actually know. You know, for so long, you maybe at work or at school would say like, oh, at home I have a cat or at home I have a bird or whatever. And people might know that about you. But through social media, you can see photos, you can see videos, you get to know them. And then when that pet dies, you can actually, you understand better maybe why this person's mourning, as opposed to often pet grief, I think, feels so sort of isolating because it's like, well, no one else knew my cat like I did. Like, I think more people get to know dogs often just because you take them out of the house and you walk them around. And like, I got to know so many of my neighbors through Seymour. But you know, you think it's this private relationship you have. So in some ways, the internet kind of opens that up to more people. And so therefore, more people then can be aware and know when your animal is sick or has died. And then people can reach out to you. Like my friend Annie Hartnett, who's a great novelist, she always talks about how when her dog Harvey was sick and dying, she was like living out loud on Facebook and like posting all these updates about his surgery. And when he died, she said she got like 40 sympathy cards from people because they saw these updates. But like, if she hadn't been posting about that stuff on the internet, if social media didn't exist, it would have been, you know, maybe her really close friends would have known. But like she said, you know, former students of hers or people who were just like fans of her books wrote her really kind messages. So I do think the internet is a great way to find community when you're grieving. But then like what you brought up, getting to know animals, you don't know the people, you don't know the animal. They're these like celebrity pets, right? There's been a lot of talk about, you know, parasocial relationships in general, where you get to know somebody through social media, or let me rephrase that. You feel like you get to know somebody through social media, even if you don't actually know them, right? Like a really popular example is everyone's always talking about how they feel like Taylor Swift is their best friend. And it's like, she doesn't know who you are, but you feel like you know her through the internet. And that totally happens with like famous pets as well, right? I follow way too many pet Instagram accounts and I'm always trading posts back and forth with my friends. And it's sad when they disappear from your life. And again, it's a nice way, you know, a lot of people who are like pet influencers have written about, you know, how much kindness they felt from people who followed their account when an animal died, and that they had this whole community of people who loved this animal and reached out to them to say, you know, how much their dog posts meant. So I think in some ways, all that stuff really normalizes grieving about animals because it just kind of makes it more public and more visible. And it's something that people have been doing forever and feeling upset about forever. But I think it just kind of puts a spotlight on it to show like, it's normal, it's okay. Everybody who loves an animal goes through this. You're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And something that you, I think it was in your introduction, and that was one of the things I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to get in touch with you, B, because this is amazing. But you had talked about pet grief being a disenfranchised grief. And I just really felt that. I don't know. I just had not heard that put into words before, but I guess it just hit me of like, yes, it does feel like a disenfranchised grief. Do you feel like books like yours and maybe some of the more active conversations we have around pet grief, we can get to a place where we're grieving our pets in a way that we would our family members and it's not viewed any differently?
I hope so. I mean, I think unfortunately there always are going to be types of grief that are disenfranchised that we are less comfortable talking about as a society than others. You know, like common examples when people talk about disenfranchised grief are having a miscarriage or even not exactly a death, but grief over a divorce or a house burning down, you know, things that are sort of like a little less cut and dry than like my mom died. And it's like, okay, that's like a more socially acceptable type of grief to understand. So I think there's always going to be sort of like a hierarchy of grieving, if that makes sense, which I don't like that that's the case, but I think it's a way that people try to make sense of things. And so I think it's easy often for people to belittle their own grief over a pet dying because they think, well, I'm sad about my dog, but at least, you know, my mom didn't die, or, you know, at least my dog was really old and this person lost their puppy when, you know, the puppy was really young. So like that must be a lot harder for them. And I think it's a way to try to rationalize it or belittle it or get yourself to compartmentalize your feelings and move on quickly. But I really hope that through books like mine, through social media, through other great books, like my friend Karen Fine wrote a book called The Other Family Doctor, which is about her experience as a veterinarian, but it's also about her experience losing her dog to cancer. Like, I hope that these just, you know, make these conversations happen more regularly. And, you know, every time I've done a book event, people are honestly excited to share stories about pets that have died and the different things they did to commemorate them. And what kills me every time is every time there's somebody who's like, you know, I've never really talked to anyone about this before, but it feels really good to share these things. And so I really hope that people will start to see the value in sharing their feelings and sharing, you know, these conversations with other people who get it. And that will just help, because I think in general, like with all types of grief, you know, it helps when you can find other people who have been through it, who understand, who've been there, and who can kind of support you. So that is my hope.
I think especially when I was grieving my animal soulmate, and I guess in some ways I'm still grieving, but you feel as if you're the only person who could ever feel this level of grief. Like, is there something very lonely about being in that grieving space? It feels very much like, it seems so silly to say, but there's no one else who could possibly feel as bad as I feel in this moment about losing my pet. And I think that that was something that I really took away from your book, is just in reading it and knowing that there was a person behind the words who wrote this, is that you are not alone in your grief, that there is a person who's been through it and seen the other side of it and sees you in your grief. I think that that was just, it was really, personally, my main takeaway from your book was that piece of like, I'm not alone in this. There's somebody else here who feels this too, or who has felt it.
Definitely. And that to me really applies to all types of grief. Like, I have several friends who've had miscarriages and they've found a lot of comfort in talking to other people who have gone through that, or finding, you know, support groups online or in person. And I think just talking about things, even if it's hard, though, when you're grieving, it can be really easy to kind of pull away from other people and be like, it's too hard to articulate my feelings about this. But I honestly think that makes it harder to kind of work through. And especially with pets too, there's often a lot of guilt that comes along with pets dying, because even though you know, eventually this dog I got is going to die one day, you know, when you adopt a dog or get a dog as a puppy from a breeder, you're sort of making this contract that's like, I'm going to take care of you best I can until you die. And even though an animal getting sick and dying is just part of life, and that's what happens, I think a lot of people feel like I screwed up somehow. Like, I didn't do my job. I didn't uphold my end of the contract. Even if your dog is like 17 years old, you know what I mean? And it's like, that's just your dog's time, right? And so one UU minister I spoke with actually runs a support group for people who are dealing with pet loss. And she said something she's seen that's really powerful is often, you know, someone comes in, they're really beating themselves up saying like, I should have done more. I should have noticed earlier that like my cat was coughing, all this kind of stuff. The person across from them starts sharing his story and is saying similar things like, oh, I should have realized it, or I should have tried this other surgery for my dog. And you start to listen and you go, well, I think that he did do everything. You know, I think he tried really, really hard to take the best care that he could of his dog. And it was just his dog's time. And then you start to think, maybe I did too. You know, maybe I'm not as bad at this as I thought, you know? And so I think having that community is really, really important.
Mm-hmm. And something that I have heard a lot in conversations of pet grief is the decision to euthanize and the overwhelming feeling of, I wish that one day I would just wake up and they would be passed away, and they passed away in their sleep, and so I didn't need to make that decision. I have heard that from so many people, and I think there is a certain amount of grief or guilt, I guess I should say, associated with either thinking that or delaying euthanasia because you just wanted the pet to pass on their own and not have to kind of quote unquote deal with making that decision. That is something that I think should be more normalized because I've heard it from so many people who have had that feeling, but they just don't want to say it out loud that I just don't want to make this decision. I want them to make the decision for me so I don't have to go through it.
Yeah, no, I have heard that from so many people I interviewed. I felt that myself with Gwen when Gwen was towards the end of her life. Even though we'd already had to euthanize Gus, I still didn't want to have to make that call again. And I just kept hoping we would wake up one morning and she would just be like dead in her bed and that would be it. But I do think that, yeah, talking about those feelings, talking about the guilt, talking about the really hard decision making can help it feel less isolating and less terrible. And something that at least changed my perspective a lot about sort of the wishing, you know, your animal would make the decision for you in terms of time to die was several vets I interviewed for my book all said the same thing, which was often when they hear that a pet patient of theirs has passed at home, they feel actually like they've failed as a vet. That they were like, oh, I could have actually made it easier and more comfortable for the animal, you know, through euthanasia. So that actually, you know, to them, it feels like a failure that they didn't do their job as a care provider. And so that really changed my thinking a bit about that as well. But I think, yeah, talking about all those things. And again, like, this isn't just with pets dying too, you know, like when my grandmother was on hospice, I had similar thoughts too, right? You know, like, it's so awful. You're always waiting for the phone call and you just kind of wish it would, you know, get it over with, right? Like, get to that phone call and be able to start planning the funeral and thinking about different things. And it's hard, you know, it's really, really hard. And you feel like a bad person if you express those things out loud, but like everyone's secretly thinking them. And it's a really challenging thing. So I just hope that people can find others that they feel comfortable talking about their feelings with and understand that like we're all people and we're all dealing with a lot of the same things, even if we're different on the surface.
Was there a particular conversation or resource, I guess, in putting this book together that kind of stuck with you?
I mean, there are a lot of really great books out there. So I think even if like, you know, mine doesn't resonate with you, you know, there are other fantastic nonfiction books and even novels that write about pet death and grief in ways that I think are really profound and can help you kind of connect with things, connect with your feelings. And then I think in terms of resources, like I've been so pleased to see that so many more pet loss support groups are popping up. Tufts University, which has an excellent vet school, has a pet loss hotline, which is run entirely by vet students. And so you can call anytime, day or night, and someone will answer and talk with you while you're, you know, grieving your animal. And there's just a lot out there. There are even some therapists who specialize specifically in pet loss and pet death. So, you know, I think like just Googling resources in your area can be really, really helpful.
And I love that you provided resources at the end of your book as well. I think that will be really helpful too. Well, thank you so much for this conversation today. This has been amazing. Where can people go to find your book? I found yours on Amazon and got it in 2 days. Thank you, Amazon Prime. But where would you like to direct people to find your book or find you?
Yeah, well, you can get my book anywhere books are sold. So, you know, Amazon's one option, bookshop.org, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound. You can also go to your favorite local bookstore, which is my always favorite spot to pick up books, especially local bookstores that have pet welcome policies. I used to work at a bookstore outside Boston called Newtonville Books. And the best part of every day working a retail shift was when someone would come in with their dog. So, support your indie bookstores that love pets. And then if you want to know more about me or my book, you can visit ebbartels.com. You can also get in touch with me that way through the contact form on my website. And you can also follow on Instagram. I started an account just for the book called Good Grief Pets Book, all one word on Instagram. And I've been posting pet tributes on Tuesdays. And I like to think of it sort of as like a virtual pet cemetery where people are honoring their animals. But then it also has Alive Pet Thursdays, which are people's current pets posing with my book and other, you know, interesting facts and stuff that got cut from the book as well. Photos, behind the scenes, all that kind of information. So feel free to follow me on Instagram there. And then you can go easily scroll through the good grief content right alongside all your favorite Instagram pets as well.
If I didn't say it enough throughout the episode, I loved this book and I really do recommend it. Honestly, I think that this is such a great companion to have to start some of the difficult conversations with family, with friends, even with colleagues about pet loss and grief. It's also a really well-researched book. I believe EB mentioned in the episode that it took her around 10 years to write. And you can tell it's just very thorough, very thoughtful, and yeah, just really well-researched in general. And I know that we are not supposed to judge a book by its cover. That's a little bit of a faux pas. But the cover is also just so beautiful and cozy, and it just draws you in. To me, it feels like the type of book that I want to curl up by a fire with my animal soulmate and just devour. A photo of the book and all the animals that EB chatted about today can be found on our official podcast Instagram page at Animal Soulmates Pod. And links to all things EB Bartels can be found in the show notes of this episode too. Real quick, before I let you go, I wanted to end with five words in good grief that have really resonated with me. And honestly, I have not been able to stop thinking about. At this point in the book, EB was quoting Barbara King, who is the author of How Animals Grieve. And Barbara was sharing a story about an elephant named Tara and a dog named Bella, who were very well bonded, really great friends. And unfortunately, something ended up happening to Bella and she died. And Tara the elephant was devastated and she very strongly grieved the loss of her friend. And Barbara King stated, "With great love comes great grief." And I don't know about you, but I will take the experience of great love with an animal 100 times over, knowing that the consequence will eventually be great grief. Hug your fur babies close, and I'll see you next week. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Animal Soulmates podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a positive rating or review. Follow us on Instagram at Animal Soulmates Pod for updates and pictures of our guests with their beautiful animal soulmates. This podcast is produced by Citizens of Sound. Our theme song is Mastering the Art by Big Score Audio. Have a story that would be a good fit for the show? Send me an email at animalsoulmatespod@outlook.com. That's Animal Soulmates with an S, POD@outlook.com. Finally, are you thinking about adding an animal to your family? Why not consider adoption through your local animal shelter? There are plenty of dogs and cats just waiting to become someone's animal soulmate. See you next time!